Hello and welcome to the FinTech Newscast. Please hit subscribe to keep up to date with the latest in FinTech news. Welcome to the FinTech Newscast. My name is John. Today we'll be talking about chatbots and their inroads into more of the customer service world of banking, and financials expansion into every facet of the banking world, and IBM's blockchain app store, which is making more and more blockchain technology apps available to financial services. With me today is Monica.
Hey, John.
Hey, thanks for joining. And Ken.
Hey, how's it going? Great to be here.
Good. Okay, so our first article is on Google's announcement of their enterprise product for chatbot technology. They have a product called Contact Center AI, which is designed to automate and reduce costs for large companies. And they're certainly not the first one to enter this space. IBM has their Watson Assistant. Facebook offers Wit.ai in a still restricted kind of mode. Microsoft has Lewis via an API. And Amazon has a product called Lex that they sell as part of their Amazon Web Services products. And this is interesting. Google uses their technology called Dialogflow, which is it's trying to make it sound more human. Mm-hmm. So they add things like ums and ahs and other kinds of things like that. So it sounds like, you know, a totally rad person is calling you, man, just to make an appointment. You know, if I manage to get my ums and ahs out of the way I talk, maybe they'll think I'm a bot.
It could be. I mean, first off, I think it's really interesting that you have so many big players in this space. Like some of the biggest companies in the world, period, are fighting over this space. I also, in less important news, I'm fascinated by the naming conventions here.
Oh, really?
Wit, Rasa, Luis, and then Google, Contact Center.
Yeah, that's true.
Is it really Center, R-E, Center?
Maybe it's the British. It's the British spelling
nice.
For those like listening. C-E-N-T-R-E. Maybe it's the British division that...
yeah.
They have research everywhere.
Maybe they just wanted it to feel really international.
And there are a lot of large companies are rolling these out as part of their service. Ergo is a division of a German insurance company. That uses the Rasa chatbot. Yeah, chatbot. So they automate about 30% of their customer service inquiries
and
using that.
That is a very impressive statistic. 30% of your customer service inquiries
are irritated by talking to a machine.
But probably something like 98% of your customer service inquiries are irritated.
Yeah, well, we've talked about how much money these things are supposed to save, you know, tens of billions of dollars over the next few years that these are supposed to save in terms of eliminating all the humans, which we must do. We must eliminate the humans.
I got to say, I feel like a chatbot could be a step up from a phone tree, though, because I feel like that's an infuriating experience. And they're both annoying, but I feel like chatbot could be less infuriating somehow. You can get through it faster. There's less checkpoints. There's less like double checks.
Yeah, if you can skip ahead in the whole menu system.
Yeah, it's just infuriating to have them slowly list out the numbers and then have to wait each time.
Oh, yeah.
Well, one of the things that I think we're going to lead into in our next article that we're covering also kind of ties into the fact that while these are great for companies and hopefully great for consumers, they do take a significant expense to bring to your organization. It takes a lot of time and money to really make this work on the ground.
Yes, a very complicated AI technology, a lot of effort. And one company that's trying to get around that is a company called Landbot. In a separate article in TechCrunch, Landbot just landed $2.2 million from NADA Capital, that's N-A-U-T-A Capital, in order to do what they're calling their dumb chatbot. which is kind of
I love that.
Which is what they're describing as like the old fashioned choose your adventure book kind of a chatbot. So it's really focused on mobile. So it's like a text, and then they give you two choices. You know, I'm feeling sad or I'm feeling happy. And it takes you down the different trees, and presumably a lot quicker than maybe the voice or the phone menu, but in a kind of a friendly dialogue-based way.
What I thought was interesting about their approach is it sounds like it's a lot simpler to set up, and they're specifically gearing small and mid-sized companies, particularly their own marketing firms. So the marketing firms of small to mid-sized companies, which when you think about the world of AI, that's probably a market that's pretty underserved. And this could be a really good, great bridge technology, but it could also be great for companies that just don't have the mega budgets that some of the big boys have.
And I also love that it's bringing the video game technology of the 80s to the chatbot.
Very
world.
Good point.
That's super important. Like, you remember the games where it'd be like, you're in a room, what do? And you just start typing random things, like, look for flamethrower.
Well, I don't want to see that you died of dysentery.
Right, yeah, exactly, Oregon Trail style.
But, yeah, it's that same idea. And I like that it's reducing, like the way they describe it, all this unnecessary complexity and expense and to cover thousands of different scenarios that might not apply. They just reduce it down to what you'd need.
Yeah.
And they mention in the article that they describe it as, of course, a much shorter implementation, something that doesn't require all the big firepower of technical expertise to implement, and maybe even as a prototyping tool for a more complex AI, or maybe just in a more focused area. Like you said, it doesn't have to handle everything. It can handle just one subpart of what the company is doing.
In fact, I think Landbot, even one of their representatives, mentions that part of what they're going to use their funding for is to move from Valencia, Spain, to Barcelona.
you got to start somewhere.
That's right.
Might as well be Barcelona.
Yeah.
You could do a lot worse.
I love this quote. No matter how well-trained our chatbots were, users were constantly dropped off the desired flow, which ended up in 20 different ways of saying, talk to a human. So I wonder if there's an uncanny valley thing happening with where we are in AI. You know, it's kind of where there's some like early Pixar films, good, but then you get to, you know, Polar Express and the AI is just too frustrating and creepily sort of human, but not human. Whereas it's like, oh, it's a sweet little bot that's just trying to direct me through a phone tree. Like, maybe people are more receptive to that.
The Minecraft of
right, exactly. If you know, if you know exactly what level to expect, then maybe that's kind of a better way of doing it.
And we have all screamed, talk with a human.
Yes, right. Well, let's go to the opposite of a simple, focused company, Ant Financial.
Mm-hmm. So Ant Financial is getting some nice big profile in the Wall Street Journal. And we've talked about Ant Financial a bit on the podcast, but for those of you who forgot or haven't listened to earlier episodes, Ant Financial Services Group, which was founded by Jack Ma, who of course is also the founder of Alibaba, is the world's biggest financial technology firm. Full stop. Some of the things, just to give you a sense of the scale of what Ant Financial does, they handled more payments last year than MasterCard. They control the world's largest money market fund, and they've also made loans to many, many millions of people. So what's interesting here is that Ant Financial has come to be one of the biggest fish in a very big pond, which is China, for the most part. And Ant Financial has gotten so big and so omnipresent in different elements of the Chinese economy that they've really started to have regulators come after them. This is a big, beefy article. And if you are at all interested in it, I highly recommend that you read it on your own. But we will cover some of the different elements that are covered here.
Well, they must be doing well if the regulators are coming after them now.
They are definitely doing well. And I think some of this is the age-old dynamic of maybe the regulators might have been interested in you anyway, but the other people who were regulated by that regulator are really interested in what you're doing to their market share. And they are pushing for some extra scrutiny and these kinds of things. So some of the elements that are covered in this article are around Ant Financial kind of sucking in deposits from people across China. So they...
I thought that was funny in the article, how they mentioned that they're stealing away like the best depositors from existing banks. And I was sure that the next paragraph was going to say, so then they started doing their own mobile payments, but it didn't. They didn't say that at all.
No, they didn't say that. And that's it. That's a good point.
They said they would add restrictions now to people using Alipay. Instead of competing with them, they're just trying to strangle their competition.
Well, not only are they like, you know, big, large parts of the financial landscape, but they've got the special ties to the, you know, to the Chinese government. And so they've got a lot of connections there, and they're probably also used to being able to swing that weight around. So it's pitting two different parts of the way that China's economy and government relationships used to work against like the new modern way of doing things. And it'll be interesting to see where that tension lies.
The tension is definitely there.
And we do see that a little bit in the U.S. with new non-financial competitors and figuring out what are we going to do with these guys? How are we going to regulate them?
Absolutely.
And that's times 10. In a more controlled environment like China.
And we don't have really any equivalent, I think, to an Ant Financial, right? You know, you could make the case that your PayPals and your Squares and your whatnots have maybe eaten up some of the market share that the big banks would have had, but it's nothing on the scale of Ant Financial. So one of the things that I was very interested here is that Ant actually had been trying for a number of years to build a national credit scoring system that would apply across China. The Central Bank of China effectively cut that effort off, and they basically forbid other banks in China from using the information that Ant Financial was gathering for that purpose to be used when evaluating whether or not to make a loan.
Yeah, China wants an official government credit scoring system instead of private ones. Is that what they were trying to get at?
I have to say, I don't know all the details of that, but the Chinese government definitely did not want Ant Financial's approach to kind of be the one that might kind of create the foundation for a national credit system.
Yeah, interesting. The article didn't really mention whether that was part of the impetus behind it, whether that government kind of credits slash social scoring, you know, mechanism was behind it. But I suspect it's both. I suspect it's like they want to preserve their initiative at the government level to rate every Chinese citizen. But I think they also want to, it's also kind of a protectionist keeping Ant in its place.
Mm-hmm. One of the things that I'm particularly interested in is the relationship between financial firms generally, whether or not they're tech-based or not, and their regulators. So this is something that I'm really interested in. Nonetheless, when you look at some of the things, some of the innovations that Ant Financial has brought to the Chinese market, they're really profound. One of the things that's covered here, and I apologize in advance for my butchering.
All right, let's hear it.
Oh gosh, now I'm getting really nervous about how I'm saying it, but Yue Bao. But that actually translates to leftover treasure. And this is one of the ideas that Ant Financial employees had of letting customers just kind of put their money in Alipay, which the equivalent might be whatever your PayPal balance is. If you've had that like $10 PayPal balance that you haven't transferred into your own bank account, they let their customers put that in an online money market fund. And as almost anything that takes off in China, it scales so fast. You know, it was it became a huge, huge multi-million dollar product like that.
Right. This sounds like it triggered a lot of the banks to cry foul and to complain to the government.
I definitely think so. So Alipay started paying people interest on this, and then the banks complained because people were putting more money into their Alipay balances. And then banks, God forbid, had to pay higher interest rates to their own depositors. Can you imagine? No wonder they're irked.
They might have to compete eventually, too, with their own products.
Well, I think to me this is really interesting because it's similar to a lot of Chinese infrastructure. They get the latecomers advantage to some degree in building out this financial plumbing. Similar to how the U.S., you know, we were way ahead of the curve, first wave for stuff like, you know, railroad tracks and airports and
land,
stuff like that.
Phones.
Yeah, like highways. But now the age of that infrastructure is showing, whereas China, they can basically build that out in a new fashion. And so the financial plumbing in China is much newer, and Ant is really taking advantage of that, whereas old school Chinese banks kind of work on this old statist model that really shares more with our banks in a lot of ways than with the fintech companies. So I think it'll be interesting to see that.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why I think like things like Paytm in India will be really interesting, because India is kind
how
of
you
on
say
that. I don't know. That's how I say it. Unfortunately, it's been several years since I've been to India, but yeah, I think it'll be really interesting how India's financial plumbing and infrastructural plumbing, you know, kind of takes off. And then Southeast Asia is in the middle ground. So it'll be interesting to see. I was intrigued to see some, there's been some work on using remittances as a way to get into other markets. So
The only other thing that I'll add from this article, because I'm obsessed with the small little details, apparently it's not just common, but really the practice when you go to work for Alibaba or Ant Financial to take on an alias.
I saw that. That was awesome.
to choose a name that you would like to go by within the workplace, since you didn't get to choose the one you were given. And one of the things that they mention in this article is that lots of people only know the alias name of their coworkers. And they also say that it helps to bring down some of the perception of hierarchy inside the organization.
Hmm.
Should everyone pick an alias, and should they tend to have names pulled from the kung fu world, because that's what
it's
Jack Ma is into?
Right. Great. Yeah, that's definitely a lot going on with Ant Financial, and it'd be interesting to see if they end up growing outside of China and around the world, expanding, and how they do that.
Well, they tried to buy MoneyGram, and that was shut down by the regulators here in the United States. So some of it may be a case of where they're welcome.
I was blown away by the scale of it. Like, wasn't it like $8.8 trillion of – no, did I get that number wrong? $8.8 trillion? It feels like too high to be believable.
Yearly payment transaction volume for Ant Financial, $8.8 trillion.
I mean, that's crazy. That's – I mean, that is nearly half of the U.S.'s GDP in transactions. I mean – anyway, the size and scale of it is amazing, and I don't know if the average American understands the kind of depth and power of those financial markets as they grow.
No, and what we're referencing here is one of the charts in this article. The largest money market fund that Ant controls is worth $219 billion. The largest money market fund that JP Morgan controls is $134 billion.
Yeah, and Ant's not even a bank, or it's part of a technology. It's not even trying, and it's past JP Morgan, basically.
Yeah.
So I don't know if you've heard, but China's a big market.
You know, I've heard that in a couple of places.
Right. Great. Yeah, no, a lot here, and we definitely recommend going to that article. As usual, we have the links to all of our articles that we reference in our show notes. And on to IBM, our former giant here in America.
That actually has more of their employees in India than they do in America now.
Yeah, that's right. I
saw
that. Yeah.
They have significantly moved
their
employee base. Mm-hmm.
There. Yeah. Well, another thing that they're trying to do is set up a blockchain app store for financial services. So insurance companies, banks, others included. But what they're doing is that they've created something called Ledger Connect, in which approved vendors can put their apps on so that participants in their permissioned blockchain can download those apps and use the benefits of blockchain without having to go through the whole process of testing and implementation from the very beginning on their own.
IBM is kind of taking on the role of Apple in terms of, we're going to vet, we're going to take some responsibility for vouching for the quality of this product, And you're going to be able as a customer of IBM to kind of come in and choose which of these might be most appropriate for you. It's a great way to winnow the world of blockchain options. I think it's a really smart play for IBM to make in terms of being a respected arbiter in the world of blockchain.
Well, they're certainly working very hard on trying to be relevant for the next wave of technology. They're investing in a lot of ways in blockchain. This particular effort is focused on Hyperledger apps, but they said they're open to including other protocols in the future, like R3's Corda, and that's been a blockchain that's that a lot of banks have been working with and testing. And even Ethereum as well, which is really focused on building a platform and software and these kinds of enterprise applications. So those make sense. Those are very related.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, this really reminded me of Ethereum's kind of platform play with smart contracts. But what is 10% of trades are subject to mistakes that cause costly delays? That just seems like a crazy stat to me. Right,
potential errors.
It's just amazing to me that there's like that much uncertainty potentially in the, you know, existing legacy trading systems that I guess I shouldn't be shocked, you know.
It does make you think you should really go back and check your own receipts.
Right, maybe I should be keeping my own blockchain ledger, immutable public record of all my trades.
But actually that touches one of the major modifications that financial services firms need blockchain firms to make, which is they cannot have all of these be public.
Right.
So one of the modifications that that the firms offer to be on this app platform is to have a private option because financial services needs some of that.
These are much different animals than Bitcoin.
Mm-hmm.
We know that blockchain is open source and can be tweaked as needed, and that's certainly the case with these enterprise type of applications.
I would imagine that also just feels a lot more comfortable for banks, too. They're used to maintaining their own mainframes and these legacy systems that have been kind of holding things together for a long, long time. Something that is public would probably feel very uncomfortable.
Yeah, and I'm sure the IBM name still carries some enterprise weight. You know, if this was the Google blockchain app store, I mean, you would almost be afraid to ask if there's ads that would be included in the apps. So there is some trust, I think, more than
absolutely
Facebook, Google.
IBM's business is consulting to big companies and helping them make, you know, the best choices in a changing world. And, you know, you can knock IBM for a lot of things, but there are not as many companies that have been around as long as they have and are still actually relevant to whatever degree they are.
Yeah, that's definitely part of the selling point, I'm sure.
I think it'll be interesting to see how the legal framework evolves for things that are based off blockchain, especially smart contracts, because, I mean, basically, if you execute a smart contract that's buggy or you wrote a mistake into it, you have no recourse. It's not like a regular situation where you call the lawyers back in the room, you know, renegotiate it and do it. The smart contract's out there and stuff's being executed. So then do you fork or do you, like, rescind smart contracts and that ruins the ledger kind of concept? So it'll be interesting to see how that plays out legally. Like, what happens if trades are what happens if you have a buggy contract?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I think with these kind of permissioned blockchains like this one, they can go back on their own and make changes like that.
Mm-hmm.
But something more like the idealistic version, where the software will be the ultimate arbiter,
right?
Like the DAO. The DAO, a bit scarier.
Right. Yeah. So there's these hybrid approaches that are like, hey, we'll protect you. We've got some of the legal protections and some of the like anonymization of traditional banking system, but we're using this underlying technology. It'll be interesting to see how they merge those two kind of worlds.
Mm-hmm. Well, another benefit from having an enterprise level app store like this is that smaller companies that have a good product, you know, they can get onto this app store and distribute to enterprises all over the world and into the JP Morgans and other large financial institutions that would be cost prohibitive, or they would have to go to individually to each one of these and make their presentation and make their case. Whereas if they get onto this blockchain app store, they can have access to all of these companies at once.
It brings the market to them. to some degree.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. It certainly lowers the bar a bit and hopefully gets more good ideas out there where they belong and not in another one of many, many proof of concepts that ends up dying and or being put on a shelf somewhere. And, you know, Bank Innovation has an article that's related to this a bit about what the what banks see as the practical applications for blockchain technology, if it's even on their radar. What's interesting about this is 30% of the respondents, and admittedly, this is not a large sample size. This is just on their website, and I think it's just a few hundred responses. But, you know, 30% on a website called Bank Innovation said they weren't even considering any blockchain initiatives. And 13% said, blockchain, what's that? 13% had that.
Wow.
Had that as their response. And 18% said that they have at least one blockchain implementation up and running. And 22% said they're working on a pilot or the infamous proof of concept.
Mm.
So it still seems like it's hazy for a lot of people, and certainly for a lot of enterprises. There might be testing, like things like international payments, but we still don't see, even on Ripple, which is focused just on international payments as their sole existence, there's no significant volumes at all.
Well, and, you know, banking is traditionally a fairly conservative industry for lots of reasons. And so I'm thinking, if I were the CIO for a small to mid-sized regional bank, I don't think blockchain would be like crazy high on my list of like, this is what I'm going to go to bat for. I'd be interested to see how some of it shakes out for some of the bigger banks that are entering in that, who certainly have more of the budget and the wherewithal to test it out and see what to make of it. But that 13%, that is a little disconcerting.
Yeah, I wouldn't want to be at their bank.
Yeah, I mean, it's okay if you're not planning anything immediately, but if you don't even know what it is,
maybe you need to read more.
How
facetious that answer was. So.
Was it in quotes, like blockchain, what's that? Sarcasm quotes.
Yeah, yeah.
So moving away from some of the things that really big players are doing, let's talk about the common man. The common man who may have a hard time waiting until their paycheck to do what they need to do with their pay. So there is a new breed of firm out there that are working with employers to allow their employees to access wages that they have earned prior to their paycheck. So an example of this is Instant Financial. So this is a mobile-based service that allows people who've signed up, so long as their employer has already signed up with Instant Financial, they can log in on through their mobile phone free of charge and say, hey, I want to take out in cash up to half of what I earned yesterday. And folks have like a 3-hour window over the course of a day to be able to do that. And those funds will be deposited into their bank account and they have it right there. So first off, when you see this, like, that is really great. I would rather have this than a payday lender any old day.
Yeah, some of the options were free, which I thought was much better than the payday loan option.
Yeah, so Instant Financial actually...
Not all of them were free.
No. Instant Financial charges a fairly modest fee to the employer, but then provides those that desired kind of advance payment to the employee free of charge. There are other firms that do charge a different fee depending on how much somebody is pulling out. But as interesting and innovation as this is, it's also somewhat disconcerting when you think about like, oh gosh, like this is the world that we live in that we have this. Mm-hmm. And just to give you some context around that, so we're currently experiencing the lowest unemployment rates we've had in America since 1969. And yet nonetheless, you know, many, many millions of people face income and job instability. And a stat that kind of made the rounds probably about a year ago is that 2 in 5 American adults don't even have enough savings to cover a $400 emergency expense. So when you look at that, if 40% of American adults are in that position, having services like this to give them some cash can be really, really useful.
Yeah, I just saw a related kind of a stat that 7.5% of people are unbanked anyway. So some of the ways they get money is through like a debit card that they get issued and they don't even have an account.
That's actually in the same article as well, that 7.5% of Americans don't have a bank account. So they often are using check cashing services and other ways to actually convert their paycheck into cash. So one of the other things, though, that they do talk about in this article, which is available on Bloomberg, is that there's some interesting psychology at play. So one of the things that that some folks consider an unintended consequence is that, well, first off, you can definitely get hooked to getting that cash. And so you could potentially kind of find yourself having advanced so much that you might not have what you need when you get the rest of your paycheck to kind of pay your rent or your utility bill. Of course you could. It seems very easy for people who might already be living on the bubble or have fragile finances for that to happen. The other thing is there is some supposition that people may stay in jobs that offer this service, even if it has lower pay, because they have more flexibility to get that pay when they want.
Maybe they are addicted to this service.
And I think it's a little bit of kind of human psychology, right? Like, you know, we all have a little, our own ideas about the time value of money, but they've done some kind of research to show that people may forego a better paying job that has more advanced for more advancement opportunities, but they'd have to wait, what, maybe even 3 weeks before your first paycheck?
Well, I imagine that consumption smoothing is a really big deal for people that are really suffering from money issues. And so that can be a really big benefit, you know, like just to the equivalent of you might take a job with more vacation time if you had the luxury to with less pay. It's a similar kind of thing.
Yeah.
But it is a sad situation that that's the reality. That brings me to another point, question I was going to ask, which is if it's employer-based, it feels like it would be large employers of like lower, like kind of lower paid folks that would do it, or is it distributed? It's like even small employers can sign up?
It's both. So McDonald's is a client of one of these firms. Sure. There is an example in the article where the employer introduced the service in February. And by June, 24 of their 30 employees had already signed up for the service. So that's not a big employer who's using it.
That's what I was wondering is like, you know, I wonder what percentage of like low income folks are like for small mom and pop, you know, work for small mom and pop operations versus large companies like Walmart or something.
Well, I actually think given some of the conclusions that this article draws, it also made me think this is actually a way for small firms to stay competitive. We may not be able to give the full benefits package that other employers might be able to, but you can for presumably a relatively small fee sign up for this service and your employees can access it if they like. And that can help you reduce turnover, which, you know, that's a great thing if you're a small business owner. Mm-hmm. So it's not that it's a bad thing, but as with so many things in life, it's mixed.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I like there's one option one of the services had to you send an emoji to get your
really nice.
Yeah.
What I wonder what the different emojis
maybe
mean.
They gamify it to you know you're even more addicted if it's gamified maybe.
Yeah. What does a wink get you?
It's like sad panda plus ice cream equals 25% of my paycheck today.
Yeah, maybe we're not the right generation for this.
Maybe not for the emoji part.
Well, with that thought, it's time to move on to our final bites, where we take a look at a number and the story behind it. I'll start with 1 billion. That's right, billion with a B. That's the number of transactions that Apple Pay processed during Q2 of 2018, which they mentioned during their earnings release. And they said that it's higher than the PayPal transactions, but they worded that very, if you have to listen carefully, because they worded it as mobile transactions. So it's not overall transactions that they've passed PayPal on. So they did a little bit of word snipping, you know, a little word parsing to get to the truth there to make themselves bigger than PayPal. You know, their move into payments kind of reminds me a little bit of your Ant Financial article, mm-hmm. where we have this technology company who's stumbled into the financial world, trying to make everything more convenient for their customers in this way. So I wonder if Apple will follow down this road if they have enough cash. And they definitely know what Ant Financial is doing. It'd be interesting.
Can you imagine Apple being your money market provider?
Yeah, I can. After that Ant Financial article, I definitely can.
My little sister, who's quite a bit younger, a completely different generation, asked me what payment platform I use. And I told her, I'm old. I use PayPal. But she uses Apple Pay, which I thought was interesting.
Oh, interesting.
She's in her 20s and she doesn't have a Venmo account.
That's so interesting.
How strange.
Like I'm a Venmo guy.
Yeah. And so this number, 1 billion, is three times the level it was last year. So they're on the way, up. And maybe we'll be comparing apples to ants sometime down the future mm-hmm. when you want to open your bank account.
So my final bite is $5.6 billion. And that is the number that was raised in June of 2018 in ICOs, initial coin offerings. So this is a place where there is still a ton of money sloshing around. So even though kind of the SEC has recently kind of tried to say, hey, you know, don't go too crazy, don't lose your shirt, lots of people are pouring in massive amounts of money into ICOs.
You know, I was really surprised. I thought with all the fake ICOs and all the press around the risks around that, that had slowed down. But ICOs have raised more in 2018 already than they did in all of 2017. And that was well before this time.
Absolutely. And I think just even in the last few months, kind of the April, May, June, I think it's possible that everything they raised in those 3 months exceeds what was raised before in totality. So we got to get an ICO going, guys.
Well, the cadence of it was interesting, too, because I feel like I don't remember the chart very well, but I feel like there was the big lump from that was probably EOS or something. I forget. And then after that, there was this kind of month was really a jump up after the 6 month kind of, you know, bear market to some degree in cryptocurrencies has just kind of turned up recently. And I do think that it'll be really interesting to see if that bullish sentiment on ICOs kind of weathers. I think right now people are saying like, hey, that's where the growth is, right? Because when new ICOs come on, they kind of get a bump, whereas the rest of this market's been stagnant.
So a bump and then a pump and then a dump.
I know the cycle is so predictable, and yet it's sort of like if it makes you money, you know, if you think you're going to be the first frog to jump out of the water, I guess.
Never be the last second.
So my final bite is $348 billion, which is the U.S. volume of person-to-person payments that were sent online or via mobile phone. And that's an increase of 21% in 2017 from the previous year. So that number is for 2017.
So all the Venmo kind of payments?
Yeah, exactly. And Zelle Venmo and PayPal as well, of course. So I just thought, you know, it's a really large number if you think about it. What is that? That's it's approaching like 2% of GDP, something like that. So, you know, person-to-person payments are starting to really come into their own. And with 21% growth year over year, that's huge. The article also mentions Zelle, which is the attempt of the banking industry to basically kind of compete with Venmo on the basis of like a Ferrari chassis on a 40-year-old kind of technology.
ACH forever.
Yeah, exactly. So
you're still cool, Grandpa. Don't worry.
I know, exactly. And, you know, I work in the technology industry, so this process of bolting a newer front end onto like a really janky old system is very familiar to me and usually does not end very well. So it'll be interesting to see if they can compete. But overall, I just think it's really interesting to see the banking system become disaggregated like this. I think of, I don't know if this metaphor is really apt, but I always think of how, you know, I don't think we would have predicted stuff like Dollar Shave Club or, you know, all these kind of consumer lines that do full vertical. They're started in a, you know, in a garage by six people, and they take over an entire segment of the consumer industry that used to be owned by like Procter & Gamble. And I feel like right now we're in this golden age of consumer finance that way, where there's been these real niche needs that haven't been fulfilled by the banking system.
Soon you'll be bragging about that. Like, oh, my bank operates out of a garage.
Right, exactly. Oh, garage bank. I know them. They serve
handcrafted.
They serve $8 billion cappuccinos. And they offer an Ant Financial money market account.
Yeah.
But it is kind of funny to think, when was the last time you paid someone back with cash?
Yeah, I still remember the $20 you owe me, Monica.
Yeah, so, you pay me in cash sometimes. No, vice versa.
I'll Venmo you. Don't worry.
Great. All right, thanks. That's it for this episode of the FinTech Newscast. Please feel free to email us any comments, corrections, information, suggestions at info@fintechnewscast.com. All of the links to the articles we discussed will be in our show notes. Please remember to hit subscribe to keep up with the latest in fintech news. And thanks for listening.
See you next time.
See you later.